For the folks who are leaving academia, the one thing I would say is it's going to be okay.
Welcome to the latest episode of Wisdom at Work, Philosophy Beyond the Ivory Tower, where I interview people who translate philosophy into successful careers outside the academy, to tell their stories, how they found their way through the wilderness and reinvented themselves, and distill the insights, the decisions, the strategies, the books, the tips, and the secrets to their success. If you're new to the podcast, I would recommend checking out the trailer and episode zero, where I go into the background, the rationale, and the goals of the podcast. If you're interested in what I like to call people's Batman Begins stories, how they became who they are professionally, how they got their big break, how they found their success. If you are an undergrad considering declaring a philosophy major, or a graduating senior with a philosophy major wondering what the hell you're going to do. If you're a master's student in philosophy, if you are a PhD in philosophy, if you are an academic, maybe even a full professor, and are looking for some outside-the-box, unconventional ways to apply your career, whether that is as a hobby, as a side gig, or maybe even as a career transition, then I think you're going to find a lot of value in these interviews. Today, we wrap up part two of my conversation with Ryan Stelzer, former management consultant and currently an executive coach at Strategy of Mind and Leading Minds, an executive coaching organization. Today, we go into some of the challenges that Ryan faced in moving from working for the government in the White House to moving into the private sector and developing a business, becoming an entrepreneur. And in particular, his advice to young people trying to figure out their careers, whether coming from a humanities background or a philosophy background in particular. If you'd like to support the podcast and help it grow, there are a number of things that you could do. First of all, you could share with a friend or family member, a classmate or a colleague. Share it on your socials. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Or subscribe and maybe write a short review on iTunes. If you'd like to leave feedback, if there are topics you'd like to see covered, or if you'd like to recommend a guest or be a guest, drop me a line on our website, www.davidestory.com. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Ryan Stelzer. Moving into management consulting, did you hit any headwinds given your background in philosophy, or was it not a problem at all, or was it an asset in some way? Was it something that people's ears kind of perked up at, or that people were interested in, you know, what you had to say?
It's a great question. And I would say this, that there's two opposite answers. And the one answer is, if you're going through traditional avenues, if you're going through traditional means, so submitting an automated application on a company's website, I will almost guarantee that it will be rejected if right. You put philosophy down as your major. Interestingly enough, I was always hired by people who studied philosophy, had a spouse that studied philosophy, or were interested in philosophy. So my consulting manager that we was hired by, my White House boss, my Ex-Im Bank boss, they were all interested in philosophy, so they knew the benefit. Mm-hmm. And they hired me because it was sort of a unique distinction. There was, of the PMFs that year, I was the only one with a philosophy degree. Mm-hmm. Of the fellows that year in DC, so those 2 years, so it was something that it definitely helped me stand out from the crowd, but I would not say it helps through traditional methods, but right. through personal association, it's very helpful because it does distinguish you from the other economics majors.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that's an interesting strategy too, because it's with the reigning ideology of STEMism, I think in education and in the business world, of course, everybody's in a panic to become economics majors, right? But if that's what everybody's doing, then that can lead to a kind of groupthink. You would think, at what point does somebody with a different perspective become, an asset? So I imagine that is the mentality that you're also trying to bring to the businesses that you work with?
Yeah, without question. I think, you know, there's obviously a very strong STEM first attitude, and that's great. And technology is incredibly important. One of the things that we faced when we were sort of advocating and articulating the benefits of philosophy was, oh, you're opposed to STEM. You're providing the opposite argument.
Right. It's either or.
Yeah, they're not mutually exclusive. Not true at all. And the way that I try to explain it is that one of my favorite quotes ever was a French biologist, Jean Rostand, said, "Science has made us gods before we are worthy of being human." And I always felt that the humanities, of which philosophy is a part, makes us humans that are worthy of science. They're not mutually exclusive. One of the most profound statements ever written was Carl Sagan's analysis of the pale blue dot. You know, when he saw the image of Earth taken from this satellite tens of thousands of miles away.
Yeah.
There's an image of this black of the galaxy. It's pitch black. You know, you see stars, and then you see this tiny little pale blue dot. And his six paragraphs that he wrote reflecting on that. I mean, this is an astronomer, and he's engaging in philosophy. And I think so much of the scientific community is opposed to philosophy and opposed to the ideas of philosophy because they view it as an argument. They view it as, oh, well, we're better than you.
Mm-hmm.
I always think, you know, I remember when I was studying abroad, I was at Cambridge, and the departments there was a hierarchy. You know, the chemists looked down on the philosophers, who looked down on the religion majors, who looked down on the chemists. So it was like this vicious circle of superiority in academia.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking that this is ridiculous, one. And two, you see it so much today. I feel like it's not either or. You know, you need both. And we need the humanities. You need social scientists to help us make informed decisions about science. You know, is artificial intelligence ethical? What does it mean to be, you know, what does it mean to be an artificial agent? These are philosophical questions. I know that they might not identify them as philosophical questions because they don't like the term,
right?
But it actually, you're engaging in philosophy. When you talk about the need for science, when you talk about science communication, that's not science. You're engaging in a qualitative skill.
Yeah. Well, and it's with take something like climate change, you know, you have so many scientists just beating their heads against the wall, not understanding why the public is and policymakers are not sort of, you know, getting in line. Well, it's because there are other issues at play of beliefs and values that people hold that might bar them from just accepting the scientific evidence, you know, so you need to take into account theory of mind and other things. So, yeah, I think it's very relevant what you're getting at. And I would imagine having spent a year studying Francis Bacon, you would be well positioned to, you know, show Bacon was, you know, first and foremost a philosopher who was challenging the dominant philosophical views of the day, especially Aristotle. But also that there was a sort of ethical imperative behind his approach to science and the acquisition of knowledge, and that we very much live in Bacon's world. And it's arguably not taking us where we want to go in terms of our relationship with nature and so on. So all of which is to say, I think you're putting your finger on what has become, particularly with regard to how philosophy has been regarded by science, prominent scientists like Neil deGrasse Tyson, Stephen Hawking, who's said philosophy is dead, is a kind of caricature of the subject.
I think it's absolutely without question. And the caricature, I think, stems from academic philosophy. I think they see conversations happening in the academic community that they view as nonsensical, and they might say, well, do we really need to talk about what the meaning of the is, you know, in philosophy? do we really need to have that conversation?
Bill Clinton, depends upon what the meaning
is. Exactly. Yeah. Now that was actually relevant in a legal sense, but no, it's, I think that much of the headwinds that philosophy, the subject, faces today is a result of the philosophical community that is centered in academia. And there was a wonderful, wonderful New York Times piece that was, I forget the authors, but it was called When Philosophy Lost Its Way. I believe it was published in The Stone.
Yeah, it was Adam Briggle and Bob Frodeman.
That was wonderful.
I am actually looking at their book that they turned that op-ed into a book. I'm actually looking at it right now on my desk. I have it flagged for reading. The book is called Socrates Tenured.
That's great. When we hang up, I'm going to Amazon, and that will be what I purchase next, because that op-ed was wonderful, and it's it's difficult because it's a world that I always had one foot in. I had 2 feet in for a long time, and I still sort of, you know, my social circle has obviously a lot of academics in it just because of my peer group, having studied philosophy for so long. Mm-hmm. And I love philosophy, and I love the professors I had. I had wonderful experiences at university, but there are some challenges. And I think, you know, we talk about science communication. I think there's philosophy communication and there's humanities communication that needs to happen as well. And it can feel silly at times. You know, there's definitely, you know, you write it, you spend, 2 years writing something that maybe 3 people are going to read. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely merits to it, and it's important, and it's an important subject. And I know it's important to have a catalog of ideas and a history of ideas, because I think a lot of philosophy is actually history. It's a lot of cataloging who people were, what their ideas were. And there are some people that I think that are sort of driving the bus now as far as, you know, moving philosophy forward and actually producing new content as opposed to analysis of existing content. Right. But there's definitely some challenges. And I think a lot of the gripes people have in the scientific community, it's almost like professors making fun of other professors. That's what it feels like. You know, mm-hmm. Neil deGrasse Tyson making fun of philosophy professors as opposed to the subject of philosophy, because his book, Space Chronicles, which is a wonderful book, opens up with a passage about one of the Apollo astronauts who went up to the moon, and he was looking back at Earth. And he said something to the effect of, you know, looking out here makes you want to go down to Earth, grab a politician by the neck and say, what the hell's the matter with you? Look at that. And that's philosophy. Yeah. Like it or not, that's philosophy.
Yeah. I love that you're pointing to deGrasse Tyson, and you mentioned Carl Sagan before. My own initial intellectual awakening was really catalyzed by Sagan.
Yep.
Reading Cosmos, reading Contact, reading Pale Blue Dot. What I realized later was that it was kind of the philosophical gravitas of how Sagan presented science that was what hooked me. And I suspect that a lot of people's interest in pop science stems from the same thing, you know? So I think that, you know, sort of some of our popular public scientists are stimulating or tickling people's philosophy bone. You know, in some ways, maybe science has usurped the role of stimulating that sense of philosophical wonder that maybe philosophy proper used to hold.
Absolutely. I suppose I have no choice because I am on record, but I'd say I would go on record and say that the Pale Blue Dot, that summation by Carl Sagan might be the greatest piece of philosophical literature written in the 20th century. I would actually say that. I know that that would be met with absolute outcry and by all of the Heidegger academics, and all. I'm sure that there's a Wittgenstein scholars who would say I am it's nonsense. But I would say that six paragraphs is one of, if not the greatest piece of philosophical literature written in the last century.
Mm-hmm. I would not have that reaction. But I think if we're talking about capacity to touch a great amount of people and instill in them a great sense of intellectual humility or existential humility and wonder at the cosmos, at life, at existence, then I think that beats anything Heidegger ever wrote.
Yeah, there's definitely a commercial appeal that Heidegger does not have.
Yeah. Well, and this issue of, you mentioned kind of philosophy communication or humanities communication, you know, I think in some ways that we don't need to treat that as separate from the actual doing of philosophy, because, you know, I always bring this back to Plato's cave from the Republic, and that the most important thing is for the philosopher to go back inside the cave. And what that entails is translating what he or she has seen outside into images and stories and a language and a vernacular that's accessible to the people who are still in the cave. And so that's part of the philosophical art, you know, is how to use skillful means to translate ideas and insights and arguments into a language that will actually register with people and connect with them and move them. And I imagine that's part of what you and David have been trying to figure out over the last couple of years in getting your business off the ground.
It's a similar exercise, absolutely. Yeah, it's figuring out how to go back into the cave, and it's a small selection of the cave because we're dealing with a specific community. But yeah, how do we describe the shapes and figures that we see? It's very, very difficult. It's exceedingly difficult. It's one of the hardest things we do.
So you moved through the White House job. It sounds like you learned a lot, quite enjoyed it, and then moved into management consulting. And that was, I guess, it was around that time that you made the decision to not go back to academia?
Exactly. So I had been in consulting for a little over a year. It wasn't all that rewarding, I would say. It was not intellectually stimulating. I wouldn't describe it. Academia I found far more stimulating from a cerebral standpoint. But you know, there's certainly it's interesting to, you know, to work in consulting and to have these sorts of face these business challenges and sort of solve them on the fly. But it was not something that I wanted to do long term. I didn't love it. And I was thinking about going back. I didn't know what to do, go back to DC. I really was unsure. And a friend of mine, who coincidentally was a history PhD that was one of the speechwriters at the White House, he sent me an article that was in The Economist, and he physically cut it out of The Economist and snail mailed it to me. And I remember I grabbed it out of my mailbox in the morning. I walked to the subway, listened to my audiobook, and got to my desk. And first thing in the morning, I opened the mail while I was sitting at my desk. And it was just this one page from The Economist and a little card from him that said, you know, thinking of you, hope all is well. And he signed it. And the article was called Philosopher Kings. Mm-hmm. And it said, the premise basically was that business leaders would benefit from studying great writers. And I read that, and it was like, you know, the cartoon light bulb went off. It was genuinely that. I was sitting at my desk. I knew it was one of the rare moments, probably the rarest moment of clarity in my life, where I knew exactly what I was going to do next. I mm-hmm. had no idea how to do it. I didn't know the mechanism or the means, or I had no idea the method, but I knew this is what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And coincidentally, referenced in the article, there were a few people, but one of the people referenced in the article was a guy named David Brendel, who was a psychiatrist that was working in Boston. And this is an Economist article, so he could have been anywhere in the world. He happened to be working in Boston, and he used philosophy in his psychiatric practice. And so I sent him an email. And I just, you know, poured everything out in the email. It was a moment of psychological safety and trust to write this letter to a stranger. I was hoping there was doctor-patient confidentiality or something, but I wrote it to him, and I just said, would be great to meet. Read this article. You're in it. I'd love to talk to you. Have this idea. We went to a coffee shop, and an hour and a half later, we had a company. It was, you know, we hit it off right away.
And the adventure had begun.
It started right there. Yeah, it was one of those really rare. I hope everyone has one moment like that in their life. I really do, because I know they're rare, and they seldom occur. But it was just this absolute moment of clarity. Sitting there, holding the Economist article, emailed David shortly thereafter. Sat down with a blank piece of paper, and we didn't intend on forming a business partnership when we met. I just wanted to talk to him and get his feedback and see mm-hmm. how he did it and learn from him. There was never the intention of my sitting down with him saying, let's be business partners. That was never crossed my mind. He actually said it. And I remember we were sitting there and he said, yeah, I'm happy to help and answer any questions you have, but you know, maybe there's something here. And, I was completely clueless, as always. You know, he's 10 steps ahead of me at all times. And so we sat down, put the piece of paper down and sketched out an idea for what we wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So it am I hearing you right? It kind of sounds like that you found a mentor of sorts as well. Somebody who had already to some extent tried to work out how to practice philosophy outside an academic context.
Yes, I without question. He, yeah, mentor, friend, colleague, all of the above. He's, you know, it's funny because I would joke with people that when you start a business, there's a huge psychological toll. And I would strongly suggest that you pick a psychiatrist or psychologist as your business partner, because that's very helpful during the development of the company, because there are many times sitting there, you know, laying on his couch as I'm just in agony over our failures and our shortcomings and realizing that I'm actually in therapy, and not without even knowing it. But he, he's been remarkable to work with. I don't want to say he's older than me because he'll be upset, but he is, he has more experience than I do without question. And he is, yeah, he's been just the greatest partner you could ask for. And we've become good friends, independent of the company. You know, if the company were to, if we were to sell it tomorrow, I have no doubt that he and I would still talk every day or almost every day. I mean, we talk obviously at great length now, but it would, we'd still probably chat as frequently as we do, or certainly on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I could see that the nature of your own relationship and sort of the culture of your own business would be especially important given what the business is. Right. So, I mean, I imagine there must be to some extent a notion of practicing what you preach.
Absolutely. That comes up all the time. If we're dealing with, we were just over in Lisbon, actually, and we led a seminar for a group of people. And one of the questions that they said was, do you guys do this? You know, we were engaged in that inquiry, and we said every day. And it's true. We had just come from a meeting where David and I. That's all we were doing. It was just constant active. I mean, we, because of our philosophical background, I think we've been equipped with some of the tools, and we really genuinely have these profound discussions. And it's not always about work. I totally acknowledge that. Like, we might stray off topic and veer off topic from time to time, but we accomplish more in less time, I think, than any other relationship I've ever had with a professional before. I mean, it's just, we sit down for dinner and, you know, within 2 hours, we will have built something that we were, you know, we will draft an article together, or we'll, you know, build content for the app, or, you know, whatever it is. We are remarkably efficient. And I think so much of that is our philosophical background and philosophical training, that it's equipped us with the skill set to be efficient and to, you know, to really understand how to hone in on the argument, you know, figure out what's the core point, the core principles, and how can we move this forward? You know, what are the next steps? What can we do? How can we develop? How can we grow? And it's something that we're constantly, constantly engaging in.
Yeah. So I think this is a good time to shift into some skills-based questions. And I think that these are probably might be some of the most helpful things for listeners, you know, some of whom might be thinking about, you know, whether they might want to leave academia, or they've left and they're figuring out, you know, how am I going to make this transition, and all the angst that goes along with that. So could you describe some of the most difficult challenges transitioning? Were they psychological? Were they logistical? Did they have to involve gaining new skills, you know, changing your identity, you know, professional identity, whatever direction you want to take that question in?
It's a great question. I would say, as far as skill development, no. Generally speaking, unless they want to become a heart surgeon, unless you're interested in becoming, you know, something that requires extensive training for many years, if you're entering into the business world, chances are you can pick up what you need to know professionally in a matter of weeks or months. It's you know, business knowledge can be acquired. This is published in the Harvard Business Review, I think, a couple of years ago. There was a professor who said the knowledge to be a successful CEO is not rocket science. I mean, there's formulas you can learn, and yes, there's experiences, and the MBA might be helpful, but you could get a good sense of an MBA fairly quickly. The skills that you learn as a result of studying philosophy don't come as quickly. Mm-hmm. And so that skill set, I think, is far more important. Because too, especially with the rapid rate of technology and the increase of globalization, I mean, things are moving so quickly that chances are you're going to have to learn new systems every 3 to 5 years anyway. So the foundational and fundamental knowledge and skills that you have as a result of pursuing a humanistic field is paramount. It's of foundational importance in comparison to maybe a traditional business background. And you might think, you know, might experience some imposter syndrome when you're sitting there amongst all the other finance majors, like, geez, I don't actually have a degree in finance. I don't know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. That's probably true on the first day. But as you continue to learn and engage with them, you'll find that you can pick it up pick up some of the skills, I think, fairly quickly, because you have these foundational skills that are far more important. Mm-hmm. One anecdote that I would share is when we wrote that first article, the Philosophy Company article, I received an email from a woman who it was kind of a sad email. She had said that she had pursued philosophy. She wanted to become an academic. I don't want to say which country because I don't want to, I want to make sure she remain anonymous, but mm-hmm. she was from a country in the Middle East. And for personal reasons, she had to leave academia and working as a receptionist in an office, and she hated it. Mm-hmm. And she said that she felt as though she had failed and that she was a traitor to her true self and that she didn't actually identify anymore with being a philosopher. And she felt that she was a traitor to Socrates, essentially. It was this, mm-hmm. it was very touching. And I wrote back to her there's a number of reasons why we don't enter into academia. You know, maybe it's personal, maybe it's financial, maybe it's professional, whatever the reason is, there's plenty of people who have pursued degrees in philosophy or taken one class that love philosophy that don't have a PhD in philosophy or even have a career in philosophy. They're not professors. And I said to her, you know, as soon as you've had that moment of awakening, as soon as you've had that aha moment, you know, the cave, as soon as you've seen it, you are always a philosopher. You're never not a philosopher, whether you're a painter, a receptionist, a dancer, a musician, you know, whatever you are, you're fundamentally human. And as a result of being human, you engage in philosophy every day. And that was one of the things I tied back in with, you know, philosophy is so relevant to children because children engage in wonder. And that's what really good children's books help kids engage in that experience and engage in that exercise. And I said to her, you're always a philosopher. You're never not. And so continue to be a philosopher, you know, in your current work and in your current role. If you have to do it for X, Y, and Z reasons, then those are understandable. Maybe you have a family. Maybe there's things that get in the way of your academic career, and that's okay. You know, but you're always a philosopher. As a human, you have the fundamental capacity to engage in philosophy. And when you have that aha moment of the cave, you're hooked forever. And yeah. So she's, from now on, she will always and forever be a philosopher.
Yeah. I really like this enlarging of the frame of what counts as philosophy that I'm hearing you emphasize and that I saw you emphasize in some of your writings and in the TED Talk, because it's really just getting at like how to be a human being as much as possible, whatever you're doing. So it's less about what you're doing or a circumscribed set of activities or a certain career or job title, and more a sort of attitude or a sort of mindset that you bring to whatever you're doing, that there's always philosophical questions lurking in the background or under the surface of any endeavor that we're engaged in. So the idea seems to be we just need to become more aware of those and, you know, take those into account, follow those leads, whatever it is we're up to.
Yeah, the closest definition I have found to what it actually means to be a philosopher is Diderot's, that was in the encyclopedia in the 18th century. His encyclopedia, you know, if you read that definition, that one page definition of what it means of philosopher, you know, just Google Diderot philosopher and just read. I don't actually think he wrote that. I don't remember if he wrote that passage or someone else wrote that passage. But that definition, it's lengthy. It's a few pages long. Yeah. But that definition of a philosopher is probably the closest thing I've read to what it means to be a philosopher.
Cool. Well, we can look that up and put that in the show notes later. Yeah, I mean, this reminds me of another quote along these lines that I love. It's from John Maynard Keynes, the British economist, and it goes something like, "Practical men who like to think themselves free of any intellectual influence are usually the slaves of some defunct economist." Yeah, like, in other words, you can't avoid philosophy. You can't avoid basic assumptions about the way the world is, the way human nature is, the way we ought to behave, and so on. So choose your philosophers carefully. And if you don't want philosopher kings, then you're going to get economist kings. you're going to get somebody dictating or imposing a certain way of life or value set or worldview in power. So be careful about who that is and whether you passively, unconsciously adopt them. Sounds like in terms of skills acquisition, that was not a major hurdle for your transition. But were there important new skills that you had to learn as you, you know, when you decided I'm going to start a philosophy company.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was the skills associated with entrepreneurship. But I think that even those are maybe even more personal in nature. I think there's a lot of, you know, you have to be a bit stubborn. You have to, you know, have sort of this attitude that this confidence that I know it's going to work. And I just got to, you know, if I just work a little bit harder, this constant drive. And it was definitely, I think work ethic is one that you certainly had to have as I shifted into the entrepreneurial mindset. But, you know, similarly, there are a number of lists out there on a number of different websites that are reputable websites, not links on Facebook, but, you know, real publications that have these catalogs of business professionals and CEOs or other successful people who have degrees in philosophy or studied philosophy or history or, you know, a similar subject. And it's remarkable literature. It's you would be surprised, I think, to see some of the people that have degrees in the humanities that are sitting atop Fortune 50 companies, yeah, or that are, you know, serious entertainers or, you know, whomever it may be.
Yeah. You mentioned LinkedIn before. Reid Hoffman. Reid Hoffman background. Did he do a master's, was it?
I think so. I don't remember.
Yeah, I think it was a master's at Oxford in philosophy. There's other folks who've left academic philosophy to go into other professions who have recommended his book, The Startup of You, as a guide for beginning entrepreneurs. So I can put that in the show notes as well. But yeah, I think it's a great point you make that it's actually more common than people might think.
Yeah, it may seem daunting and overwhelming when you're sitting there as the philosophy major in the room of biology majors or finance majors, but there's a good chance that someone sitting at the top of the organization has a humanities degree. And it's definitely comforting to see that, hopefully adds a boost of confidence or a jolt of confidence to the folks who are in the application phases or transitioning phases of out of academia, that there are a number of people out there who have done it before and who have found success and have made a positive contribution to the world in which they operate.
Mm-hmm. So this decision to leave, there's a quote that I love. I actually don't know who it's from. It says, "All men should strive to learn before they die what they are running from and to and why." So when you left, did you see it as leaving academia, or did you see it, you know, kind of doing that with sorrow and regret or trepidation, or did you see it as running towards something? Did you feel pushed out of academia or pulled towards something outside of it?
I thought of it as broadening my experience before returning. So I thought of it as sort of taking an alternate route for a little while and then coming back to it. And I thought that that might be a different experience. I was always interested in being unique, and I never wanted to be the sort of traditional candidate. And so sure enough, when I got into academia and I saw myself as sort of on a traditional trajectory and traditional academic path, I wanted to do something different and separate myself from my peers that were, you know, all pursuing the master's and going straight into the PhD. I wanted to try something else that was a bit different. And so I always viewed my relationship with academia for those first few years was always, I'm coming back to it. I'm just doing something else right now. And then when it came time when I actually sat down with David and we were sitting there in the coffee shop and we decided, okay, we're going to do this, I knew that it was essentially, I don't want to say putting a nail in my academic career, in the coffin of my academic career, but I knew that it was probably not going to happen at that point. Unless we failed miserably in the first couple of years, I thought, okay, I'm going to go back to academia. This is my safety plan. So I always have kind of had one toe in the door. I've always wanted to kind of go back. David and I joke about that all the time. Like, why don't I just go back? You know, we'll go back in another PhD and do that because it's what we love. We have these philosophical conversations and we miss the academic environment. I miss having these types of stimulating conversations like that, sitting around that table with Ralph Lerner and the fellow students. I've never experienced anything like that after leaving academia. There's nothing that comes remotely close to that. Mm-hmm. And so that is something I genuinely miss. And I wish I could get back to without question, but it's, you know, I'm foregoing it in the service of something else. And I wanted to sort of broaden the perspective of philosophy in other people and instill philosophy in a professional community. And so decided, for better or worse, to sit a couple conversations with Ralph Lerner out, and then potentially go back one day. It was always my attitude was that I was just doing something else for the time being. But yeah, it looks like now that I'm probably, the PhD is not something that in philosophy is not something that I'll be doing in the near future, at least.
Yeah. What do you know now that you wish you'd known before you left? And related to that, how would you redesign your undergraduate or graduate program to better prepare you for where you are today or where you'd like to be with your work in philosophy?
That's a really, really good question. I feel like I'm talking to Larry King. That's a really good question. you have suspenders on because I can see you sitting and just... What do I wish I knew now? What do I wish I knew then that I know now? I would say I wish I knew that there actually was another path, or that was going to be okay. Because I think for me, when I was on that track and I was in my first year of my master's degree, I didn't even conceive of there being something else or an alternative.
Right.
My Greek professor when I was in college said, "How do you get the philosophy major off your doorstep and you pay for the pizza?" And so I always thought that was it. I had no other alternative. I didn't really ever conceive of doing something outside of completely so far afield of what I thought philosophy was. I had a really narrow sense of what philosophy was. I had the academic definition of the subject of philosophy. Mm-hmm. And I now understand that it is a broader umbrella. And I wish I had that conception when I was younger, because I probably would have pursued other courses. I would have done things that, had philosophical bent to them, but were maybe a bit more applicable. I was always interested in applying. The reason why I studied ethics, that was my track in grad school, was ethics. I wanted to be an ethicist. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because it was applied philosophy. I always wanted to use it. I knew I didn't want to just do abstract theory. I really wanted to apply philosophy. I wanted to write. I was interested in, when I started studying logic, I was really interested in finding essentially an E equals MC squared for ethics. I wanted to see if there was a logical notation that we could come up with that would actually define adequate behavior or good behavior. Mm-hmm. That's a very broad term. And so I wish I just had the knowledge and the wherewithal that it's a broader field and that it is applied across all subjects. And having that understanding, I think, would have provided me with the confidence to pursue other things while a student.
That makes two of us. that's one thing that I'm hoping to do with this podcast and the book that I plan to distill out of it is how to compile, streamline, organize all the information from people like you that I talk to, and then plugging that into curricula to better educate students, undergrad and grad, about what else they might do with their philosophy training if they can supplement it with other courses, other programs, other certifications, whatever they might be, to prepare for a non-academic career, either as a backup or as a first choice. So I think the kind of stuff that you're doing is fascinating, because it's opening up a whole new set of possibilities of, academia as not just, the highest goal, but as one goal among many, some of which might be even more attractive. So I think it's an exciting time to be doing what we're doing. It's kind of wild, wild west of sorts for philosophy outside the academy.
It's the wild, wild west exists out of necessity, because there are, there's X number of jobs and Y number of candidates, and there's all of these people who are interested in the subject and who there are some who are interested in the subject that don't want to pursue academic careers. They're just interested in the subject. So not only do you have the folks who are interested in academia that will not become professors, but you have folks who love the subject and want to apply it in a professional setting. I mean, so many, I cannot tell you, your book is going to hopefully fly off the shelves, because I cannot tell you how many emails we get from philosophy majors saying, "How did you articulate your value to your employer? When you were working, what did you say? What were the words you used? It's such a common question. And it's, I think the question is asked, they have this tremendous skill set. And so if you just hone in on those skills that you feel that are relevant to the environment to which you are applying, like strategy, like communication, you know, these sorts of, like, innovation, creativity, these sorts of things that are very real philosophical skills, then, you know, you'll be better positioned when you're submitting your resume or your cover letter. And it's just such a common question is how do you articulate your value as a philosophy major? How can I sell myself as a philosophy major? I'm a philosophy major. You're the only company I can work for. Mm-hmm. And that's just not true. It's not true at all. There's no shortage of opportunities out there, and it's a broad world, and it's a wide world for philosophy. It's actually probably, believe it or not, far more broad for a philosophy major than it is for a finance major.
Huh. Never thought of it in those terms. I should lay that one on my students because I have a lot of students in the business school.
Yeah, you'll be met with boos and jeers. I'm used to it. One of my favorite anecdotes that I tell people, and this is genuinely true. I talked about it in the TED Talk, was when we wrote that article, one of the notes we received was from allegedly this philosophy professor. We don't know, but it was allegedly a philosophy professor that said, a philosophy company is an oxymoron started by a moron. So, mm-hmm. You know, lots of support from the academic community. We appreciate it. But we've been actually very supportive. Interestingly enough, professors who we reach out to and speak with and just sort of share what we're doing genuinely are interested, and they seem intrigued by our work, and they've been very supportive and have provided great insight as to, you know, how we might talk about what we do and the benefits of what we do. Certainly there are those that are skeptical and believe that philosophy should remain solely in academia and the exclusive property of the privileged and the, you know, the people who are anointed.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, for most of the world, I think most of the academic community knows that philosophy has a broader appeal and can be applied in a wider setting.
Yeah.
And hopefully your book and this podcast, yeah, provides, it's just one outlet for that knowledge to reach a wider community and for your students as well. You know, it's true though. There is when you study a specific subject, you're limited to that subject usually, mm-hmm. unless you study a subject that is broad and all encompassing and can be applied in a number of fields. And philosophy is one of those. I mean, you can really do anything, but I think, you know, but it gets even to a broader question about our and not to expand upon education in the United States, but looking at your degree as what are you going to do with it? I never looked at my degree as what I was going to do with it. Never once. Honest to God, I never thought, oh, I'm going to study philosophy because I want to be a philosopher. No, I studied philosophy because I was interested in philosophy. And I understand that I'm very fortunate. I came from a background where I had the privilege to be able to do that. I didn't have to worry about, oh, I need to work and I need to, you know, that wasn't something that I was in the back of my mind, and that I was, you know, working three jobs and putting myself through college just so it was a different experience for me. And I understand that I'm very fortunate to have had that experience, but still, I never thought of it as I'm doing this because I want to be this. No, it was, I'm interested in this, so I'm going to study it. And I for folks who have those interests, whether or not they're able to pursue a degree in it, I hope that they pursue their interests, and that then leads them to work or career or jobs, or they still pursue their interests and they may have to do another job to make ends meet.
Yeah.
But it is something that is, and that's not saying this is philosophy only. If you want to be an artist, then be, you know, I hope you pursue art. I hope you don't, you know, if you're interested in psychology, I hope you pursue psychology, not because you want to necessarily be a psychologist, but because the field is interesting to you. I hope that you study astronomy, not to go to the moon necessarily, but because it's an interesting field.
Yeah.
And so much, I think, of students that are applying today are Excellent Sheep by Bill deRicewicz.
Oh, it's an amazing book.
Amazing book.
And amazing it's just, book.
Yeah,
I actually teach chapters of it in my courses.
Phenomenal.
To kind of hold the mirror up to students. And generally, the shoe fits in their words.
Phenomenal. It's a phenomenal book. And it's I wish do what you want to do. Pursue what you want to pursue. Pursue interests that are appealing to you. Don't pursue something because you're being told you have to or you should, or you feel social pressure. I mean, I understand there might be family pressure, and sometimes, you know, folks pursue degrees because their mom or dad wants them to become a doctor or a lawyer or whatever they may be. And you know, that's different, and you know, that's for folks to sort out on their own. But I just hope that folks pursue interests that are appealing to them, and that students, that they just, you know, you do something that you're passionate about, and hopefully it will all fall into place afterwards. But you just, you know, there's no traditional path. There's no such thing as I'm going to go to college for 4 years and go to graduate school and get my MBA and get hired in this firm. And then I'm going to work my, I mean, it's not.
It's almost always much messier.
Yeah.
And more interesting and more exactly. of an adventure than that, you know, if you let it be. Yeah. Well, maybe sometime we will have you to BC to give a talk or talk to a class. I mean, because I think they'd be very interested in what you have to say in the business school. Because they really encourage their students to take humanities courses. And they actually have a course for freshmen called Portico for all freshmen in the business school. All business majors have to take it. And it's all business ethics. It's all philosophy. So somebody who has, you know, background in philosophy and in management consulting and working in the business world, I think, you know, presenting to them another possibility for what you might do, what you might become, I think would be cool for them.
That would be great. Yeah, there's no shortage of opportunities.
Yeah. What advice would you give to someone who is about to transition out of academia in general? And secondly, advice about breaking into your industry or field in particular?
For the folks who are leaving academia, the one thing I would say is it's going to be okay. That's my advice. It's going to be okay. There's going to be bumps and bruises, and it's going to be confusing, and you're going to wonder what the heck are you doing and how are you doing it, and I can't believe I mean all of the questions that we all experience when we're making a substantial shift in direction, they're going to happen. The one piece of advice I have is that it's going to be okay and you're going to come out of it. As far as folks who are entering into my current field, I would say the one piece of advice I have is really understand what it is your customers want and what they need and what their, you know, what their pain points are, what they're looking to develop, how they're looking to grow, and how you can help them. And if you understand what they're looking for and you can articulate how you can be of benefit to them, then you might not, you know, you're not going to make a sale every time, but yeah. You can at least demonstrate your value, and doing so, they'll appreciate the fact that you're trying to help. And if you come at it from a perspective of sincerity, because I think a lot of the business world is insincere, and that's certainly an appropriate cliche, because it is at times. But if you are genuine and you're authentic and you say, look, I know what you're going through, I can help you, I do X, Y, and Z, then you'll be well received.
Right. Well, I think we can leave it there. A lot of great material and advice and anecdotes throughout. I think that we have ample material for an episode 2 at some point, if you would be into it. I think we'd love to hear more about your company, about some of the exercises you give through your programs. I noticed you use mindfulness training in your programs as well. I think listeners would be interested in hearing about that, as well as a quote from David I found, which is he described executive coaching as 20th century existentialism transported directly from the ivory tower at Yale to the 21st century executive boardroom. So there's a lot more that we could dig into at some point later if you're interested. But regardless, Ryan, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your story with listeners. I think it's another good example of hope for those who are looking to transition into something outside the academy. So Ryan, thanks again.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And we'll hope to see you next week when I interview Ryan's partner in crime, David Brendel, philosophy PhD and MD, who not only runs the executive coaching practice, but has a background in psychiatry and runs a philosophical counseling practice. Philosophical counseling is another pathway that we'll be exploring in coming weeks. So stay tuned for that. Next, if you are enjoying the podcast in general, I would really encourage you to share it with friends, with family, with colleagues, through your socials. If you have ideas for improving the podcast, if you have ideas for questions you would like me to ask guests, if you have ideas for guests you'd like to see me interview, let me know. the net I'm casting here is very wide. It's not just, you know, academic philosophers or even people who studied philosophy at the graduate level, but, you know, people who are interested in the world of ideas and whose work engages in some capacity with that. And with that, I will wrap up. Hope to see you next week from a conversation with David Brendel.